All right, guys, welcome back to another edition of This Week in College Football, brought to you by CFB Talk Daily. Today is Monday, August 3rd. We got some interviews coming up on this episode of the podcast. We're going to do interview heavy since, you know, there's not too much going on. So, John, who do we got this week?
All right, so this week we have Alabama insider Ricky Green writes for the Tide Talk and has his own podcast. Great thing. You should go listen to it. And we also have former national champion and UCF punter, internet sensation, Mac Loudermilk. He was really cool, high-energy guy, and special teams guys love us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're big special team guys. We've had this is our second special team guy. I'm going to count what's-his-name, placeholder of the year. Should have been placeholder of the year winner. I'm going to count him as special teams. We also had Pro Kick Australia. So we are big, big, big special team guys.
And fun fact, we're super close with Minnesota's soon-to-be placeholder of the year,
Matt Stevenson. This is for message for all the college guys out there who placehold. If you come on our podcast, you pretty much are going to win the placeholder of the year.
All right, so some big news this morning. I posted it on Reddit. Hashtag We Are United by players of the Pac-12. Posted on the Players Tribune. I saw rumblings about this the other night on Twitter. Said expect it Monday. Came out a day early. And so basically the Pac-12 football players demanded the following. It's hundreds of players too. It's not just a few players. This is a big deal. So first off, health and safety protections. Allow the option not to play during the pandemic without losing eligibility or spot on team's roster. Fair enough. I think that's totally doable.
Agreed.
Prohibit COVID-19 agreements that waive liability for the school. I also think that if you have to sign a waiver saying that, like, we're not liable, it probably shouldn't be playing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mandatory safety standards, including COVID-19 measures, player-approved health and safety standard enforced by a third party. So that one is probably because of what happened at UCLA. They were saying that Chip Kelly and a few other, even at Hawaii, players were saying they weren't even tested before workouts. So,
yeah, I think having the third party there, smart. You don't have to worry about a school basically BSing a test result just so they can keep their guy on the field. So I like that one too.
Yeah, so those ones, all those, I think completely normal. Okay, so the next one is protect all sports. So here's where things get interesting. Preserve all existing sports by eliminating excessive expenditures. Larry Scott, administrators and coaches voluntarily and drastically reduce excessive pay. Fair enough, Larry Scott is the highest paid conference commissioner in probably the worst conference. So worst Power 5 conference. So that makes sense. I don't know if coaches, I mean, you can't really control the free market. So I don't know how you're going to do that. But
yeah, I don't see coaches willingly losing that all money.
A few guys have already taken pay cuts for the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And performance and academic bonuses. Academic bonuses, I guess. They just want to see you do good in school. But bonuses, the Randy Etzel one is bad. But, like, I feel like some of the other ones are reasonable. Like, if you win a national championship, you deserve to get rewarded.
Yeah, I think, incentives. Like, throwing stuff in. Like, oh, win the conference, here's a little bonus. You win your division, here's a little bonus. Stuff like that. Like, I like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so here's the next one for the Protect All Sports. This is written like the Declaration of Independence. There's bullet points, like titles. End lavish facility expenditures and use some endowment funds to preserve all sports. All right, first of all, end lavish facility expenditures. So if you want the Pac-12 to stop upgrading facilities, no one's going to commit to the Pac-12 schools. No one's going to play in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
Also, schools like Oregon, almost all the facilities are privately funded.
Yeah, you can't, like, tell, like, a private, like, I know Rutgers had the big facilities that they were building, and, they're getting a lot of money from donors, and you can't, like, tell people to not donate anymore, especially if these are people who donate every year. The school is not going to say, hey, our guys don't want your money anymore, right? Because then you're going to lose a donor.
Yeah. And, like, Phil Knight, he's donated $500 million to Oregon in his life. So, I mean, Oregon does not probably touch any of their own money to upgrade facilities.
Yeah, no.
That's so much money. Like, Rutgers gets, like, $1 million donations. And then they said, as an example, Stanford University should reinstate all sports discontinued by tapping into their $27.7 billion endowment. So Stanford has a fund where they do have all that money, but it's Stanford. It's like, I think they said 25 million of it is tangled up in a 25 billion is like into research and academics.
Yeah. Like you started it with, you know, Stanford's an academic school. They're not a athletic first school. I always say that Stanford, and a lot of people say it, Stanford is like the Ivy of the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely.
It is one, I always, I just said there's no way you're going to tell donors how to, not give you any money. And two, you're not going to have a sports program telling donors that they can't donate to academic research.
But even those ones aren't the most unreasonable things. Like the performance and that, like those you're probably negotiate with, like maybe get something out of it. So three is end racial injustice in college sports and society. Form a permanent civil task force made up of leaders, experts, and university and conference administrators to address outstanding issues such as racial injustice in college sports. Fair. You could probably get that to happen.
Yeah, I can see that happening easily, I'm sure. I wouldn't even be surprised if there's something going on, like, behind doors that we don't know about. That's something getting set up that way.
Yeah. In partnership with the Pac-12, 2% of conference revenue would be directed by players to support financial aid for low-income black students, community initiatives, and development programs for college athletes on each campus. You can't do that because of Title X, so that will never happen. You can't write for black students. I don't think you're allowed to do that for conference revenue. I think it'd have to be just for low-income students. Form an annual Pac-12 Black College Athlete Summit with guaranteed representations of at least three athletes of our choice from every school. All right, so the next one is economic freedom and equity. Guaranteed medical expense coverage. Medical insurance selected by players for sports-related medical conditions, including COVID-19 illness, to cover 6 years after college athletic eligibility ends. This one, I'm actually kind of for. Because Okay, it's going to be expensive, but, I mean, they do make a lot of money for the school with their bodies. And, I mean, for a lineman in the SEC, Pac-12, like, it does take a toll. And, like, eventually you have to pay for it on your own, but, like, for a few years after, like, the first few surgeries or whatever to get it right, you could pay for it because that's ultimately a result of what happened in college.
You know, I like the idea behind it, like, definitely the medical stuff. I'm not in love with the 6 years, though. I think that's a very long time. You know, you graduate college at 23, 24. Now you're talking to guys 30 years old, and he can still dabble into maybe getting health benefits from his college playing football days. What stops a guy from, he's 4 years out working in a warehouse, making good money, just doesn't have the best insurance, pulls a shoulder. If he can somehow say that, this is related to me playing football 4 years ago. Yeah, I think there could be a case like that. I think 6 years is a long time, but I do like the idea behind it.
Well, my thing is, like, negotiating, you always aim high. So even if they get it down to 4 years, that's
exactly
good enough.
I think four is a good year. Because then you're really getting, like, 8 years of medical insurance.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the next one is a name, image, and likeness rights and representation. You're already getting this next year.
Yeah.
So the next one is fair market pay rights and freedoms. This is the one where the Pac-12 is probably going to tell them to fuck off. Distribute 50% of each sport's total conference revenue evenly among athletes in their respective sports. That'll never happen.
Yeah, the amount of money that football would make compared to any other sport, like,
you can't.
If they did this at Rutgers, baseball would make zero money because baseball in the Northeast, you don't charge to get into games. Like, for our people who, like, listen down and, like, in the Carolinas and in California, like, they charge to get into games. Like, there's no admission at Rutgers for baseball, so, like, they can't break up zero.
Yeah, and so if you pay, and also because of the Title X law, if you're paying Rutgers football players $5,000 a month, you have to pay Rutgers baseball players $5,000 a month, even though they're making no money for the school.
Yeah, I think that's where you start losing interest.
Which is, there's no way. Although, I talked to some players in the Big Ten. They also think that they should get a 50-50 revenue split. So I talked to one today. I'm not going to say his name, but he thinks so, and I respect his opinion. And again, you aim high, even if you get a 5% split. It is what it is. All right, 6-year athletic scholarships to foster undergraduate and graduate degree completion. I think you might be able to get that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I don't think that's too out of reach to do.
Yeah, the SEC, if you don't graduate by your fourth year, they'll pay for your next year.
Yeah, I like that.
So the SEC is already at 5, I think. Eliminations of all policies and practices restricting and deterring our freedom of speech and our ability to fully participate in charitable work and our freedom to participate in campus activities outside of mandatory athletics. I mean, that is probably, like, related to the Iowa thing in the Big Ten, where they, and also, like, obviously going through, like, media relations we've done before, very hard to get guys who are currently in college to come on a podcast without getting it, like, pre-approved.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see why they want that. And also, that's probably something you could get, like...
Yeah, very, and even if it's not exactly what they, you know, what they wanted, I know they wanted to do a lot of work outside of campus. Like, you know, they might not give you all the freedom, but, you know, they might open up some doors for you. I don't think that's an unreasonable want.
Yeah. Okay. Ability. This one I think should happen. Ability of all players of all sports to transfer one time without punishment, and additionally in cases of abuse or serious negligence. Fine. That's should have been done a long time ago.
Yeah, I think one's a good number. You're, okay, you get, when you're 18, you're allowed to mess up once.
Yeah, and, like, plus, it's not really hurting anyone. Like, people say it's going to be free agency of college football. It's so over-exaggerated. Like, that's not what it's going to be. Like, I doubt it. I mean, these kids, you commit to a school open, that's where you want to go. So, unless, like, I doubt many kids are going to bounce around that much. All right, so I'm going to continue with bullet point number five. There's only two more here. This one also probably – the Pac-12 can't allow this. They don't have the oversight. The NCAA has to make this rule. But ability to complete eligibility after participating in a pro draft if a player goes undrafted and forgoes professional participation within 7 days. So basically like basketball. You don't get drafted.
Yeah. Back. Well, basketball, I don't know if they've changed
before, right?
Yeah, basketball, you're allowed to get an agent, but it's only for 7 days. You're allowed to basically get your mock.
Yeah, okay, so that makes sense. That's not going to happen before the season. And six is due process rights, which I absolutely believe they should get, because that's like basically they're saying, like, don't, if you get suspended for sexual assault, stuff like that, you should be kicked out of school right away, like or like banished. Because I'm not sure if you saw, but Washington State linebacker Dominic Civils, a former Washington State linebacker, was kicked out of school last year for sexual assault, and he posted screenshots this weekend of the girl, like, basically admitting that she made the entire thing up because she was jealous.
Yeah, I think I'm actually surprised that that isn't already, and that should be already set into rules.
Yeah, which is messed up because that's messed up.
You see, you know, you see like cases of that every couple of years. Like Sean Oakman had the same thing happen to him.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing to put into the rules.
Yeah. So another thing that we have going on with this whole We Unite or United movement is So Washington State has reportedly kicked a few kids off the team for participating in it. We're having a Washington State player hopefully with on us for the next podcast. I have to set up a date with him, but we talked it out today. But so wide receiver Cassidy Woods, apparently he chose to opt out of the season because he has sickle cell, because the coach was okay with it, and then he asked if he was involved with the We Are United movement. When he said he was, Rolovich took an issue with Nick Rolovich. He's the coach of Washington State. And then Washington State's denied this, but according to this reporter, Joan Javid, the phone call was recorded by Cassidy and included the coach telling the sophomore receiver to clean out his locker and to distance the team from the movement.
Yeah, if that does come out to be true, and of course if he has a recording, it will come out. I don't understand how in this day and age, as a coach, you can think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely not.
You know, these kids, they make so much money for the schools. Like, if they want to go out and, you know, speak on something they believe, they should have every right to. And the fact that Washington State's throwing kids off of the team for this, I don't understand how. Like, if this comes out, he should be fired immediately.
Yeah, that's what I said, because someone said new coach, and I was like, new coach might be looking for a new job, because you make their point. They don't want to be restricted for their freedom of speech, and then you go and like basically prove their point on why you have too much power as like a athletic department.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally the first day. So that's crazy. I think it's wrong. They should be able to speak their mind.
Yeah, and then it comes back to like the point you see it all the time. You know, they're even though they are student athletes, they really are more than just student athletes. And if you're a school, why wouldn't you want, you know, to be like, oh, you know, we had 10 guys who were very active in this movement. Like, that's a good thing for your school. That's good publicity.
Yeah, like, if you support the players, like, a bunch of Oregon players, I mean, not to beat the Oregon horse, but Javon Holland is probably Oregon's best player on defense, and he's participating in it. He's one of the media contacts, so he probably helped draft the whole thing. And he tweeted, like, this has nothing to do with at Coach Cristobal. He's been supportive, and I hope other schools follow the protocols we're taking here at Oregon. So it's not like – I think it's just they want the conference to have unity. Like, they want just more freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's necessarily a bad thing. And, like, the only problem I've seen is Washington State defensive players fighting about it on Twitter. And then there's, like, USC players. So no USC players are listed as media contacts. And they were USC defensive back Chris Steele was tweeting, like, I don't know what they're on, but I came here to play football. Like, so, like, they're, like, beefing about it. Like, it's, like, I don't know. It's, like, dividing them.
Yeah, and, you know, if you give them the freedom to, you know, speak on whatever they want, it also gives them the freedom to not come out. Like, you know, Chris Steele says he went there to play football. Like, that's fine. You know, if that's what your prerogative is, that's fine. But if you have kids who are on your team and your teammates want to speak out, like, and they have that freedom to, I don't see how it would be a big deal if the conference just let them do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. All right, so you want to get into our first guest, UCF punter Mac Loudermilk, internet sensation. Used to do all the celebrations after the punts. Awesome guy. All right, so we now welcome on former UCF punter, maybe even campus legend, Mac Loudermilk. Mac, welcome on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Matt.
Yeah, so we appreciate you coming on. So I want to start, before we get into anything else, why don't you tell me about the GoFundMe in your Twitter bio?
Yeah, so when I won the Hold of the Year award my senior year, the part of that we do is there's a charity aspect to it. And so I always planned to donate my hair anyways, but mm-hmm. when I won that award and kind of found out about the whole charity aspect, it just kind of seemed like a no-brainer to me. And so I knew that not everybody had hair to give, so I set up that GoFundMe so people could do monetary donations instead, just so they wouldn't have to sacrifice their hair. And all mm-hmm. that money goes to the purchasing of hair for the wigs. It goes to the research, taking care of the patients and everything. So yeah, that's what that's for.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'll probably donate to that once we're done recording because it's a cool cause. I donate awesome. A little bit to charity myself, but I'll
appreciate
do it.
It.
So now I want to talk about, so your freshman year at UCF, mm-hmm. you know, what was it like coming in there? I mean, because you didn't play what, your first two seasons, I think?
Yeah,
first...
right. Yeah.
And,
go sorry. Ahead. Sorry.
All right. And I mean, your second season, 2015, you guys didn't win a game, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, what was it like, you know, being there for 2 years, you know, on a winless team, not getting playing time?
It was rough. So, when I came to UCF from high school, from Valdosta High School, I was recruited as a punter slash H-back tight end. And mm-hmm. so, but when I got on campus my very first day, they said, yeah, just worry about punting, man. And so, I had, okay. And so, that whole first year was kind of... For me, it was kind of learning on how to be a specialist, how to approach the game from, I don't want to say not like from an athletic point of view, but more or less someone has to be so precise in what they do. I can't really afford to mess up on a play because mm-hmm. if I mess up on a play, then it's magnified and everyone knows that it was me that messed up on a play. Whereas if I'm playing tight end, you know, I miss a block. Someone could say, oh, well, he was supposed to have help here. If I run around the wrong route, someone could say, oh, well, the quarterback misses read here. But that's not really the case for being a specialist. So I spent that whole first redshirt freshman year kind of learning about the nuances about being just a punter. And then going on to the 0-12 year, that was really rough because that challenged me to figure out, you know, why am I here? Why am I playing football? Do I really love the game this much? Do I want to stick around here at this university? Do I want to transfer out? Thankfully, I chose to stay there and grow with my boys and grow with the new coaching staff and everything because I don't think I would have had any amount of the success I would have had both on field as a player and a personality at any other school. But, yeah, it was rough going, you know, you see UCF beat Baylor in the Fiesta Bowl, and then the 2 years later you can't win a game and you're ranked number 128 out of 128 teams. And so it was hard, but, you know, I'm very fortunate and very blessed that I stuck around and rode that thing out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it had to be tough. I mean, especially the first day on campus, you know, thinking you're going there as an H-back and punter, and then your first day then being like, yeah, just worry about the punting.
Yeah, it was like, if I'd have known that, then I probably would have, you know, let my recruiting go on a little long to see what else was there. But but I mean, yeah, it all worked out for the best in the end.
It's funny. Yeah, so another thing that this is a little tidbit, but you kind of reminded me of it. Did you ever see what Ninja said about punting, the streamer?
Yeah.
What an idiot.
Full of crap.
Yeah, because like you said, I mean, people don't understand. Clearly, some people have never tried to punt or kick a field goal, because if you hit the ball in the slightest wrong way, that's going so far right.
Yeah, so the biggest thing was, like, the sweet spot that we hit on a football, it might be the size of a half dollar, maybe. And if you miss the knuckle, the big knuckle on your foot, if that misses the sweet spot at all, then the punt's not going to be worth a crap. And you got to think, the guy back there that's sitting there waiting to return the punt is more than likely the most athletic person on that football team.
Yeah.
And you also have either 8 or 9 other guys coming at you to rip your leg off before you even make contact with the ball. So it's a very nerve-wracking position, and I wish that some of these people who just spew crap out of their mouths could come back there and try to catch a ball and kick it. And I think it's 2.2 seconds is the amount of time we have from snap to kick. So I wish someone could come back there and just show how easy it was. But I can promise you, people don't know the half of it.
So when I was a freshman, I was a corner, but I was slow. So I was like, I wasn't playing, but I was like, I'm going to become a punter. Probably easy. How hard is it to kick a ball? So I started practicing, and then I was like, we had different snappers, and they all sucked. It was freshman football, you know, in high school.
Yeah.
And then I gave up after like a week. I was like, the ball's going over my head. I'm too short. Like,
yeah. So funny thing is, going through middle school and into freshman year of high school, I was the long snapper, and I was just kind of screwing around at practice one day, and the head coach saw me, and he goes, forget long snapping. You're going to learn how to punt. Okay, whatever you say, coach. And then crazy how everything works out after that.
Yeah, I mean, that's weird. So now I want to talk about going in. Scott Frost gets hired. How much did the culture around UCF change when he got hired his first year?
Huge. So one of the big things that Coach Frost came in and did was just he wanted to preach to us not to be afraid to go make a play, because when O'Leary was there, excuse me, I don't want to say that he was like a dictator or anything, but it was more like authoritative based style of coaching, more very old school, very, you know, do your job. If you mess up, you get yelled at, you got to run sprints, all that kind of stuff. But when Coach Frost came in, it was more or less, it was like, hey man, look, I've played football. I realize that you're going to mess up. Everyone messes up. It's going to happen. All that we ask is that if you try to go make a play, or if you mess up, you just mess up going wide open 100%, and then we'll deal with the repercussions afterwards. And so I just kind of, we had a whole mantra, just like, you know, exceed with no fear of failure. Like, yes, that was part of our team saying every Saturday before a game, we said that in the locker room and in the team hotel, just as a whole collective unit. And it's just something that we truly believed going through those two seasons with him.
Yeah, I mean, Coach Frost is definitely, he's got a great personality. He's a guy I would love to play for, because all his interviews, he seems really genuine. So it makes sense that, like, his thing is like, hey, you're going to mess up and it's okay. Like, he doesn't seem like a dictator type.
Yeah, he was easily one of the most fun coaches I've ever played for. And I've played football for 17 years since I was 4 years old. And so it was just, you know, he would come in the weight room and knock out a couple sets of squats and power cleans with us. When we played Navy, he was the scout team quarterback running the triple option. It was just the guy, not only that, but he played as a defensive back in the NFL when he played quarterback in college. The guy's just an elite athlete, and he was like 45 years old and was hankling in 275 for sets of five in there with us. The guy's just unreal.
And he's running practice with like 20-year-old kids.
Exactly, and that's the thing that like just kind of made us buy into what he was preaching. He was out there doing it with us. He wasn't, it'd be one thing if he's saying there, yeah, you know, just here's your job, do your job. But he's out there with the quarterbacks, with the receivers, showing them on tape, and then going out to the practice field and actually running the drill for them before they actually go do the drill. And that's just something that's not really heard of in college football. But I mean, when you're that type of coach and you're that hands-on, I think it just makes it so much easier for the players to buy into what you're preaching.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And that's crazy that I didn't even know that he played a DB in the NFL. So you just taught me that. I did not know that.
Yeah.
All right, so the next year, 2017, how special was that year for you? after, especially after the winless season you went through as a sophomore.
Unbelievable. So, I mean, that just kind of gave us a glimpse as to what we could do. You're referring to the Peach Bowl season, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that for us was, as a football team, we kind of got sick and tired of, I don't want to say the disrespect, but just kind of the lack of preparation that teams were giving us during Frost's first year. Because, and it didn't help that we lost to Arkansas State in our bowl game. And that just kind of lit a fire. Like, after that game, we took it upon ourselves as juniors in the senior class to not ever let, I don't want to say a smaller school, but I mean, that Arkansas State is not UCF or in UCF's conference, just to make them realize that what UCF is capable of. And that whole offseason, that's got to easily be the hardest I have ever worked in an offseason before in my life. It was just the constant grind, the constant of setting the bar higher after every workout, after every sprint we did, just raising our expectations. And then it really was something that what coaches love, because it came important to the guys and it became important to the team. And when that happens, the coaches don't have to coach a whole lot. The coaches are just out there. It was mainly the players running practices and running workouts, because we just had that much responsibility and felt like up to us to do the job that needed to be done.
Yeah, and that's like referring to the culture thing. Like, you guys wanted to win so bad that you didn't have to be reminded to constantly put in good reps.
Exactly. The culture flipped 180. That 0-12 year, I think we had like 7 seniors on roster, and it just, not to knock those guys, but the leadership wasn't there. It wasn't what it needed to be. I got to see the highest of the highs of college football and the lowest of the lows. And I can tell you that the culture from that 0-12 season and the 14-0 season, total 180s from each other.
Yeah, I mean, that was a special season too, because like that put UFC, like, I mean, UCF, sorry, as like a household name.
Yeah, and I mean, people can knock it all they want to, but the fact of the matter is, we were the only undefeated team that year in college football. We actually won our division. We actually won our conference, and I had a nice big diamond ring in my little ring box that size from my middle finger. That someone wants to argue with me, I'll just say my ring says otherwise and show it to them. And that we're also nice. In the NCAA record books. That also helps too.
That's a good point. I mean, so going into Auburn, I mean, that was a statement game for you guys, right? I mean, I'm sure you felt some type of way about not being in the playoff, and.
Mm-hmm.
So how was preparing for that game? Like, were you guys pissed there?
Yeah, we definitely had to. I mean, so for us, it was unique, because we knew that Coach Frost and our entire coaching staff wasn't going to be there.
Mm-hmm. So you guys knew. I mean, yeah, the media said that, like, the players didn't really know, but you guys, like, had a feeling, or he told you?
No, so when we played Memphis in the conference championship game, it went to OT. And so I guess ESPN had it on a timer or whatever, but as soon as the last second of the fourth quarter ticked off, the ticker at the bottom of the screen, and our scoreboard had it on at the time too, and it said, you know, breaking news, Scott Frost heading to Nebraska for head coach. And so we kind of knew, as soon as we had a feeling leading up to the game, that was probably what was going to happen. But after the game, you know, the coach was in tears in the locker room saying, oh, he's just so proud of us, and he doesn't want us to think any less of him, just because what he did, he was doing it for his son to be close to his granddad. You know, he's trying to get his coaches more money and everything, because they still got debts to pay off and everything. And so he didn't do it for selfish reasons. He took that job because, yeah, he wanted the coach's alma mater, but I think it was also just, you know, he wanted to give back to those who have given him so much, and his coaching staff and everything. It wasn't for selfish reasons. And so we knew, and so getting back on topic, we knew that he was going to Nebraska during the bowl game and everything. And there was a point in time to where we were fairly pissed off at him, to be honest, because we found out that he was doing like recruiting trips, flying out to California, then flying back to Florida at 4 a.m., get out to practice. And we just kind of felt, you know, no, I don't want to say betrayed, but we just kind of felt some type of way about the whole situation. And finally, he called us up at the practice one day. He was like, guys, look, y'all can just tell me as men right now, if y'all don't want me to coach you in this bowl game, I'll leave. I'll go to Nebraska. Y'all never see me again. But if I'm going to be here, we're going to do this like we did the entire rest of the year. And we're going to go up to Atlanta and we're going to do our job and we're going to come out there with a W. And so him just being completely blunt and honest with us was like, okay, we know you have nothing to lose here. You already have your job and everything lined up. So all these coaches, so let's just do it for each other. And we just made it our mission to keep preparing how we always did the whole year, go out there and shock the world when we beat Auburn.
Yeah, so just to clear it up, because I don't remember, so I want to make sure. So he did coach the bowl game, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I could see how you guys were a little pissed, like kind of half in, half out, like you're recruiting for another team, like you still have a game left. Like.
Yeah. He came back and he gave it his all. You know, he was sick as a dog at practice just from not sleeping. But he was doing right by both teams for doing what he did.
Yeah. And I mean, like, obviously, I'm sure now you have no hard feelings towards him. I mean, it's his alma mater. No. He's going close to family, and plus $5 million a year is hard to say no to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now I want to talk about a little less football, and it's more about the UCF campus life. So what was about a normal week for you, like, during the season?
So a normal week for me during the season that year, I was a slob that year, to be honest. I wasn't living like an athlete should be living. But a normal week for me, meeting Sunday, they kind of go over the game plan and everything, introduce everything to us. And then Monday we had, you know, workouts, class, practice, all that stuff. And then so I think that year I had class. I want to say I had like two night classes on Tuesday and Thursday. And I think I had like one more class or something like that. And so I was taking, I think, like 14 credit hours. And so my major wasn't, you know, totally hard. I was a sport and exercise science major. And it wasn't anything. It wasn't business. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything challenging, honestly. And so I just, you know, I woke up, went to practice. After practice, if I had class, I'd go to class. And then I would go home and play Xbox or stretch. And that was really... And then when the weekend rolls around, everyone loves you when you're winning. And so me and my boys, we'd pop out at some of the bars every now and then and get treated like royalty for the most part. And that was always a fun time. And then after the Peach Bowl, you know, that was one of the greatest nights I'll never remember. So,
you know, okay. You're good. I just have to restart my answer. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, Peach Bowl, greatest night you'll never remember. That's kind of funny. I actually just turned 21 2 days ago, so I just had my, like, greatest night I'll never remember. It wasn't the Peach Bowl, but it was pretty cool. Like, yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure you guys definitely treated, like, royalty at the bars during that season, especially you. I mean, that year was kind of the year you sort of took social media by storm with your celebrations. Right. Do you have a favorite one you did?
The one against UConn after that 69-yard ball, that was raw emotion out in the field. That's probably my favorite one, because that's truly me enjoying the game of football and getting hyped up for something that happened.
So what do you do for that one? Because I'm trying to find a video, but
I did the baseball swing and just pumping my fist in the air and everything. That was the OG celebration. That was it.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome, because I mean, you made punting look fun. I mean, you're on ESPN, Bleacher Report, like people are loving it.
I mean, that's the thing to me. Like, I have such a small part of the game, but then again, it's a pretty important part. But to me, I just want to show, like, it's possible to do your job at a high caliber in punting, and then but also have fun and enjoy it, because this is very well could be, you know, the last time that you actually play organized football for a club like that.
Yeah, I mean, even just not even like your eligibility running out, like something like Mackenzie Milton, like one second you're on top of the world, and then, you know, one bad hit and it's, am I ever going to play football again?
Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, one guy diving in trying to block a punt and there goes my leg, potentially. So that's why.
All right, so I've got about like two or three more questions, if that's cool with you, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, that's fine with me, man.
All right, cool. So my last like football related question really is what was like the most intense game you played at UCF, where like the crowd was just going nuts and like?
Oh man, I would say either the conference championship game against Memphis the Peach Bowl year, or the game against USF that same year where Mike Hughes ran back the game-winning touchdown with, like, I think like a minute and 3 seconds left or something like that.
Yeah, that game that was awesome to watch.
Yeah, that was – to be there and living through that, that was just seeing 46,000 people dressed in black on Thanksgiving after Thanksgiving for Black Friday. That was unique. That was something that was just amazing.
Yeah, but I mean, and just not to go off topic, but Mike Hughes, you could tell when he was at UCF that, like, that kid belonged in the NFL. Like,
absolutely.
He was just so, like, locked down.
The kid's special, without a doubt.
Yeah, but that game, I actually put out a list of, like, my top games of the decade. That was three. Because if you want to talk about, like, pure fun standpoint, that game was just awesome. Like,
oh, it was a shootout from the very get-go.
Yeah. And plus, you guys looked cool.
Yeah, so, those uniforms were tight.
Yeah, you looked cool. So it makes it everything else looks cooler when you look cool. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. So now my last question here is, you just mentioned you play. Do you still play Xbox, and what do you play?
I'm more of a PlayStation guy now. If I get on Xbox, it's just to play Grand Theft Auto. But on PlayStation, I mostly play Call of Duty. And every now and then I'll play some MLB The Show.
Nice, nice. A man of culture. I like it. all right. So now my last thing I want to talk about is, so do you still keep up with football? And, like, you know, how much do you, like, watch special teams when you watch?
Yeah, so I watch football every weekend whenever I can. I'm still training for a shot in the NFL, just trying to stay ready for if something ever happens. The corona has really kind of thrown off this whole offseason as far as workouts and camps go. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to stay ready just in case for whatever. But whenever I'm watching football, I watch special teams just as intently if I'm watching an offense or a defense go at it. I like seeing the little nuances and how different teams cover and kind of break down different coverages and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I actually, I saw you have, like, a YouTube channel with all your film and stuff.
Yep.
So I'm now your 29th subscriber.
Hey,
so
let's go.
Hopefully we'll get you up to a little more, you know, maybe get you signed by a team. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Subscribe, share that thing out, man.
Oh, I absolutely will. oh yeah. So my last thing here I want to talk about is, it's two guys you got to watch. You got to look at Rutgers punter, Adam Korsak.
Okay.
I don't know if you know who that is.
Yeah.
But so I'm a Rutgers fan. He's one of those Australian punters. We had the Pro Kick Australia guy in the podcast.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the way they talk about punting, like, these guys love special teams. It's awesome.
Yeah. The Australian guys are something else just because of what all they can do with the football that over here in America we've never even thought about, quite honestly.
Yeah. The kid at Rutgers, he went 60 of 69 punts inside the 10 last year.
Whew. That's crazy.
Yeah,
his leg
is nuts.
That's talent right there.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a Rutgers fan. We suck, so I mean, having a good punter, it's something. Like,
he's punting a good bit, and he's doing a great job with it.
Yeah, I mean, we actually almost beat Iowa because I think we played the Iowa game, and he downed them inside the 10, I think, 7 times in one game.
Ooh, so yeah, that helps. That helps a lot.
We still lost because I think we only scored 10 points, but we came close. And then the other person, just real quick, is Matthew Stevenson. He's a holder and punter at Minnesota.
Minnesota. Yeah, I know Matt really well.
You do?
Yeah, he trained with me last year a little bit in the offseason when
funny,
I was prepping for pro day and everything.
Because I was going to say, you guys look a lot alike.
Yeah, I know Matt really well.
Yeah, so he's actually who we're endorsing for Holder of the Year this year.
Nice.
We're trying to get him on the podcast. We're actually going to release a watch list, but only his name's going to be on it. So
I like that. That's good. That's a good move. He's a good kid.
Yeah, we talked to him the other day, so that's awesome. All right, well, Mac, I appreciate you taking the time out of your, I mean, maybe busy schedule. I don't really know what you're up to, but I'm assuming you're pretty busy.
Trying to stay busy, man. Trying.
All right, well, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us, and hopefully we can have you back on in the future.
Absolutely, no problem at all. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, guys, so that was Mac Loudermilk. Obviously, UCF national champion, you know, like all the celebrations all over the internet. That was definitely a good guest for us to have. We're going to move into the SEC to a school that has had claimed national champions and backed by the NCAA. Ricky Green, he's a writer at, what is it, John? Tide Talk Daily?
Tide Talk Sports.
Tide Talk Sports. So we're going to jump into an interview with him. We talk some recruiting. You know, we just talk football in general with him. So we'll catch you on the other side of that.
So we now welcome on Ricky Green from Tide Talk Sports. I believe that's what you write for.
That's it.
Yep. So I read a lot of your articles about recruiting for Alabama. We're trying to help you get to 4,000 followers. So before we get any further, if you're listening to this, go follow him on Twitter at BamaRLG. And Ricky, welcome on.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Anytime I get a chance to talk Bama football and recruiting, I'm game. So I'm excited and I'm ready to go.
For sure. All right. So to give an introduction to this Alabama class, I want you to give me one recruit on each side of the ball that you think will be picked in the NFL draft in the first two rounds in the next 3 years.
Let's see. Right off the top of my head, I would have to probably look at one of the two offensive tackles that we currently have committed. I would go either J.C. Latham or Tommy Brockermeyer. Those big offensive tackles are in demand. You can't teach 6'6", 6'7", 300-plus with athleticism. So offensively, I'd have to go with one of those two tackles. Defensively, the way the draft picks now, you know, if you'd asked me that a couple of years ago, I might have said something about a middle linebacker, but defensive backs are in such a high priority. We got a recruit out of Ohio State. He was an Ohio State commit. He flipped or decommitted, wound up committing to Alabama, and he's a super underrated kid. Everybody that I've talked to about this young man just raves about him and talks about, you know, how much higher he should be ranked than what he is. So if I had to give you one for defense, I would probably go one that not many other people would give you and say Devonta Smith out of LaSalle High School up around the Cincinnati area.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Brockermeyer twins, we're going to get to that in a minute, because I also really like the point you made about defense, because a few years ago, it probably would have been, like you said, middle linebacker, defensive end. But with the way the NFL is shifting, it kind of like affects how colleges recruit as well.
Exactly, exactly. You know, there's a premium right now on pass rushers and defensive backs that can play man coverage. So if you can do either one of those two things, if you've got that in your skill set toolbox, you're ahead of the game already.
All right, so now I want to talk about the Brockermeyer twins. I think I'm saying it right.
Yes.
I talked to the Mike Farrell at Rivals about this, on how Tom Herman missed on these two. But what do you think Alabama did to get these two to ultimately end up committing to Alabama? Because if you look at it, they're third-generation Longhorn legacies. Their grandfather played at Texas. Their dad was an All-American first-round pick and is a member of the Texas Hall of Honor. And their older brother is currently on the team. So this is pretty hard for them to mess up. Somehow they did it.
I think that what you have here is just a perfect storm situation. And we'll talk about two different storms. A perfect storm as far as Texas is concerned, in that Texas and Tom Herman are struggling. The guys that have all the money out in Texas, the big oil money guys, are not happy. There's some uncertainty there. You hear about Herman's seat getting a little warm. So I think that all of that had to be happening for Alabama's perfect storm, which would be the development that we've had recently of offensive linemen. It seems like every year for the past few years, you're hearing a first round draft pick offensive lineman that came out of Alabama. So I think that it had to be Alabama being where we are as a program, with the need that we have at offensive line and the development that we can offer both on and off the field, and couple that with Texas being where Texas is right now. Had this happened a couple of years ago, there's probably no doubt in my mind that the Brockermeyer twins would have wound up at Texas.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's also the answer I kind of got from Mike Fowler, was he said that Tom Herman's just, he's blowing it. Like, he's blowing, like, the chance.
Yeah, and there's really no nice way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, because this is bad. Like, I mean, a lot of people, like, I feel like, so you're obviously a hardcore college football guy. Casuals don't really understand that, like, being a bad recruiter is, like, almost as bad as losing games.
Absolutely.
At some schools. Like, you can't – at Texas, you can't pull in, like, the 70th-ranked class in the country and have a warm – like, a – I mean, not a hot seat. Like, people are going to be pissed.
And, you know, as odd as this sounds, there's a team in the SEC over in the Eastern Division. You know, it brings to mind, when I hear that, I think about Dan Mullen, one of the best on-the-field coaches in college football today, surely top five or six. But the guy doesn't like to recruit, and it's going to cause him some trouble in Gainesville, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so I actually have a funny story for you. So I wasn't given the coach's name for this, but we had the director of recruiting for Rivals on our podcast. He told us a story about recently, this year, a coach fell asleep on a recruiting visit with a kid.
Oh,
didn't even
end up
recruiting him. So then maybe it was Dan Mullen. Maybe he was just.
It sounds like something Mullen would do because he is completely disinterested when it comes to recruiting. And I've never really understood it because you would think he would be good at it. I mean, the success he had at Mississippi State, he's got a whole lot that he can sell as far as the quarterbacks that he's developed and the staffs he's been on. The guy just genuinely doesn't like to do it, I guess.
Yeah, plus you're at a big school, Florida. Kids want to come there. Like, there's kids that are born with Florida as their dream school. Like, you're giving.
Yeah, not
like,
to mention Florida's like a hotbed of high school football. Florida, Texas, Louisiana. If you can't recruit in those states, you're in trouble.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so last thing about recruiting, and then we're just going to talk about some fun Alabama stuff, you know, maybe some of your, like, favorite memories, stuff like that, favorite pass players. But so I was actually talking to J.C. Latham yesterday, and I was telling him about, we're talking about this class, and he said they're trying to be great and the greatest. And where do you think this could be the best class Alabama's ever had?
It could very well rival that. There's a couple of things that need to play out. First and foremost, hats off to Ryan Day and Ohio State. They have done a fantastic job of this 2021 class, and they're going to be hard to catch. I believe the highest, as far as the 247 sports composite rankings are concerned, score-wise for Alabama ever, and I might be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure it's around 317, 318 point-wise. There's definitely a chance for them to break that with this class, and Latham is right on point. Not only for the entire recruiting class, but Kyle Flood is doing a heck of a job. That's our offensive line coach. Out here selling these recruits on putting together the greatest offensive line recruiting class of all time. So, I mean, you got 2 5-star tackles, a number one center, a number two guard with the commitment of Terrence Ferguson. We're just maybe like one piece away from them genuinely being in that conversation of greatest offensive line class of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what's funny is because a lot of people meme like Alabama kind of being like a rehabilitation center for coaches.
Right.
But really, I mean, if you look at it, Kyle Flood, I'm a Rutgers fan, obviously. Our first season in the Big Ten was under Kyle Flood, and we went 8-5, like undefeated in non-conference play. Like, Kyle Flood was a very good coach at Rutgers. Sure, some off the field things happened that ended up getting him fired. But I no doubt we think that if he didn't get fired for that, he'd probably still be the head coach now.
And I've actually, you're not the first person that's told me that. I've had people that were with the Atlanta Falcons organization and people even around Kyle Flood that have known him for years and years say the same thing. He's an outstanding coach. And had it not been for that little stumble that he had at Rutgers, there's no telling he could still be there today.
Yeah. Plus the media. Okay. So I'm not one of those like crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy people, but the media kind of had it out for him at times because they were kind of going after Rutgers for spending so much money on trying to get that push into the Big Ten, and some off the field stuff happened with players getting arrested and stuff, and the media was just hammering it away, like that there was like a culture problem, stuff like that, and it really wasn't all that.
Well, and you turn on the news and you see, you know, every offseason it seems like you've got 5, 6, 7 guys from University of Georgia getting arrested, or, you know, it's just, it happens everywhere. It's sad that they made that big of a deal out of it and tried to magnify it that much when it's really a problem that you have at every school.
Yeah. I mean, they're kids. It happens. It's just, So now the last thing I wanted to talk about with you, well, not the last like little subject here, is I want you to tell me what made you an Alabama fan? Like, you know, what shaped your Alabama fandom? How did you start writing about Alabama?
Well, mine started generations in my family. I guess the first that I can remember is my grandfather. He went to Alabama. My dad is an alumni. I actually started my bachelor's degree at Alabama and wound up finishing at Georgia Tech. I have a bachelor's in science and mechanical engineering. That's what I do for my real job. So, it's just always been, man, and I've always enjoyed talking about football so much. I was kind of not a bookworm, but I always enjoyed writing and reading growing up. So when I had an opportunity to put all those things together that I love to do anyways, I jumped on it. Touchdown Alabama Magazine was my first big site that offered me a chance to write about Alabama and cover football and recruiting. So, you know, those guys over there are like family to me. I always appreciate them. Steven Smith is their lead college football analyst over there, and he does a great job. And he, you know, he pretty much taught me everything I know about covering college football and writing about it in particular, and the correct way to go about writing about it. So,
yeah, I mean, that's pretty interesting. So the mechanical engineering degree, that's crazy, because, I mean, you have like a lot of followers. I mean, it's hard to become a writer for a career. I don't think people really understand like the work we got to put into it.
Right. Yeah. And see, I've only been at this for a couple of years. So I've really, you know, I feel like I'm very fortunate to have the amount of followers that I have and people that read my stuff and, you know, the opportunities that I get to do call-in shows and podcasts. I'm just really excited about all of it. It's kind of a dream come true for me. I didn't come out of school as a journalist, or when I came out of college, I had no inclination whatsoever that I would ever be a journalist of any kind. So it's really just kind of a deal where, you know, an average guy got an opportunity to do something that he absolutely loves to do. So it's really kind of a cool story, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing for me. I'm still in college. My degree isn't anything to do with journalism. It's kind of far away from that, actually. And here I am, like, I have 17,000 followers on Twitter, and I think about it, like, all the time, like, damn, should I maybe, like, switch? But I don't know.
You know, those decisions are hard to make sometimes.
Yeah, they're definitely hard. All right, so now my last question. I had one saved up for you here. This is going to be the last question. It's going to be a tough one for you. If you had to pick two players on offense and defense as players of the decade for Alabama.
Two on offense and two on defense.
Yeah, I feel like one would be a little too hard. So,
well, I could do one, but I'll give you two because I'd rather give two. All right, so the first one,
sounds good.
Without a doubt, if you talk about player of the decade for the University of Alabama and somebody doesn't at least put Julio Jones in that conversation, then I'd have to kind of question their Alabama fandom right off the bat. Julio Jones has to be one. Defense, we can go a guy like maybe Marcell Dareus, a first-round defensive lineman. More recently, Eddie Jackson. Eddie Jackson is now the highest-paid safety in the National Football League, and he was actually a cornerback to start with at Alabama. Got an injury. Nick Saban went to him, said, "Hey, Eddie, look, you've lost a step from your injury. But if you'll trust me and you'll play safety, I think you'll be good at it." You know, here a few years later, he's the highest paid safety in the NFL. So Eddie Jackson and Marcell Dareus on defense, and I'll go Julio Jones and, of course, Tua Tagovailoa on offense.
Damn, so Tua gets the spot over. It's hard when it's Alabama. There's so many options.
It really is. I was in the Georgia Dome for that second and 26, and I've just never experienced anything like that. I had just finished feeling the lowest of the lows. He got sacked, second down and 26. We just lost this game. 3 seconds later, Devonta Smith runs a freaking go route to the left side of the end zone. Tua drops it in there, touchdown, Alabama wins. That was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
So my co-host is a bartender, and we were sitting at the bar, me, him, and my friend Tom, who's a Georgia fan, avid Georgia fan. And we both had money in Alabama. He obviously wanted Georgia to win, and we were ripping him the entire game. And now here we are thinking, oh, we're going to have to hear this the whole ride home, like, you know, they're going to win. And then Tua out of nowhere, 2-26 happens, and my jaw dropped. Like,
that was incredible, man. I don't think I know I've never seen anything like it before, and if I ever see anything like it again, it'll have to be something really impressive, because he just, I don't know, and his whole attitude about it. You know, Nick Saban, too, even joked after the game, Saban was getting on to him about taking that sack, and he looked at Nick Saban and said, "It's all right, coach, I had a plan. I just needed more room to throw the ball." Like, get out of here, man.
Yeah. And, you know, so just last little tidbit here before we wrap it up is, so I'm actually a Rutgers, Oregon fan. That's my, like, kind of flip-flop. I know it doesn't make any sense, but Oregon really butchered the recruitment of Tua Tagovailoa, so that was...
Yeah, no doubt.
Because, I mean...
A former Heisman Trophy winner from Hawaii, you would think that they could have got that done.
Yeah, I read from a lot of people, they say that they think if Oregon would have offered him sooner, he probably would have ended up at Oregon.
I think that probably is accurate, but I will tell you this. just from speaking to some of his family members and people that know, there was always this little shade of doubt into his head whether he wanted to be in Marcus's shadow that much or not. So they did have that one little thing playing against them, but I think you're right. If Oregon would have really put on the big time push, Mario Cristobal is a freaking incredible recruiter. Incredible. Mm-hmm. I think that if they had started in on two a little earlier, we may not even know what second and 26 ever was.
Yeah. So you know what all great recruiters have in common, right?
What's that?
They've all coached at Rutgers. Mario Cristobal, Kyle Flood. It's all
the Rutgers coaching tree. Yep, that's it. See, I was sitting here thinking about the Nick Saban coaching tree, and I learned something today. It has nothing to do with Nick Saban. It's about Rutgers. I should have known that.
Well, I mean, Mario Cristobal was at Rutgers for 3 years before he went to Miami and then Alabama. The more you know.
The more you know. It's a crazy how intertwined these coaching webs can get. Sometimes you don't even really know it until you start really looking back through somebody's history, all the places that they've been. It's pretty incredible sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so I'm going to wrap this up, and then there's one thing I want to tell you about quick. Well, I have like 10 minutes left, but off the recording.
All right, cool.
All right, so Ricky, thank you for coming on. You know, maybe we could do something for your article, help you get to 4,000 followers any way we can, but we hope to have you back on in the future.
Hey, anytime you want to talk about Alabama football and recruiting, I'm here. Like he said earlier, I'm BamaRLG on Twitter, one half of the Bama Bros and a writer. I'm the lead recruiting analyst for TideTalkSports.com. It's what I love to do. Might as well be doing it with you.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Ricky. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy.
All right, guys. That was Ricky Green. So we talked some Alabama football. So we've traveled the country a little bit today. We talked a lot of Pac-12, really. Went into the America for a little bit, then jumped into the SEC. We're still hopeful that there's a season this year. A lot of news. It's given us really no answers yet. So keep your eyes on Twitter. Hopefully we have some good news in the coming days regarding college football. And until next time, guys, see you soon.